and rewriting the goddamn parameters. We just don't know why the C-12B shaped range safety charges on the SRBs and ET record a transient current flow when no enable functions have been transmitted. Roger thinks maybe the LSC enable leads or the C-12 compound itself can accidentally allow the static discharge to simulate a command signal. Oh, hell. Tell them, Roger.
Mr. Colvin, came the voice from Marshall. Colvin cleared his throat.
That's what we've been watching for some time. Preliminary data suggests that temperatures below 28 degrees Fahrenheit allow the zinc oxide residue in the C-12B stacks to conduct a false signal. If there's enough static discharge, theoretically.
But no solid database on this yet, said the voice from Marshall.
No, said Colvin.
And you did sign the critically won waiver certifying flight readiness on the last three flights?
Yes, said Colvin.
Well, said the voice from KC, we've heard from the engineers at Bonet HCS. What do you say? We have recommendations for management there.
Bill Montgomery had called a 5-minute break, and the management team met in the hall.
God damn it, Roger. Are you with us or against us on this one?
Colvin had looked away.
I'm serious, snapped Montgomery. The LCS division has brought this company $215 million in profit this year, and your work has been an important part of that success, Roger. Now you seem ready to flush that away in some goddamn transient telemetry readings that don't mean anything when compared to the work we've done as a team. There's a vice presidency opening in a few months, Roger. Don't screw your chances by losing your head like that hysteric McGuire.
Ready, said the voice from KSC when 5 minutes had passed.
Go, said Vice President Bill Montgomery.
Go, said Vice President Larry Miller.
Go, said Vice President Steve Cahill.
Go, said Project Manager Tom Weiscott.
Go, said Project Manager Roger Colvin.
Fine, said KSC. I'll pass along the recommendation. Sorry you gentlemen won't be here to watch the liftoff tomorrow.
Colvin turned his head as Bill Montgomery called from his side of the cabin.
Hey, I think I see Long Island.
Bill, said Colvin, how much did the company make this year on the C-12B redesign? Montgomery took a drink and stretched his legs in the roomy interior of the Gulf Stream.
About $400 million, I think, Raj. Why?
And did the agency ever seriously consider going to someone else after? After?
Shit, said Tom Weiscott. Where else would they go? We got them by the short hairs. They thought about it for a few months, and they came crawling back. You're the best designer of shaped range safety devices and solid hypergolics in the country, Raj.
Colvin nodded, worked with his calculator a minute, and closed his eyes. The steel bar clamped down across his lap, and the car he rode in clanked higher and higher. The air grew thin and cold, the screech of wheel on rail dwindling into a thin scream as the roller coaster lumbered above the 6-mile mark. In case of loss of cabin pressure, oxygen masks will descend from the ceiling. Please fasten them securely over your mouth and nose and breathe normally. Colvin peeked ahead, up the terrible incline of the roller coaster, sensing the summit of the climb and the emptiness beyond. The tiny air tank and mask combinations were called PEAPs, personal egress air packs. PEAPs from 4 of the 5 crew members were recovered from the ocean bottom. All had been activated. 2 minutes and 45 seconds of each 5-minute air supply had been used up. Colvin watched the summit of the roller coaster's first hill arrive. There was a raw metallic noise and a lurch as the roller coaster went over the top and off the rails. People in the cars behind Colvin screamed and kept on screaming. Colvin lurched forward and grabbed the restraining bar as the roller coaster plummeted into 9 miles of nothingness. He opened his eyes. A single glimpse out the Gulfstream window told him that the thin lines of shaped charges he had placed there had removed all of the port wing cleanly, surgically. The tumble rate suggested that enough of a stub of the starboard wing was left to provide the surface area needed to keep the terminal velocity a little lower than maximum. 2 minutes and 45 seconds, plus or minus 4 seconds. Colvin reached for his calculator, but it had flown free in the cabin, colliding with hurtling bottles, glasses, cushions, and bodies that had not been securely strapped in. The screaming was very loud. 2 minutes and 45 seconds. Time to think of many things. And perhaps, just perhaps, after 2.5 years of no sleep without dreams, perhaps it would be time enough for a short nap with no dreams at all. Colvin closed his eyes.
Diablitos by Cody Goodfellow. What's worse than being stopped at customs in a South American country while trying to smuggle out contraband? How about being sealed in a 727 at 30,000 feet with a hellishly lively stolen artifact in your carry-on bag? In this story, Ryan Rayburn III is faced with both. Cody Goodfellow is something of a mystery. Did he really study literature at UCLA? Does he live in Burbank? Did he once earn a living as a, quote, undistinguished composer of scores for pornographic videos, unquote? Maybe some of the above, maybe all, maybe none. Two things are for sure. He knows how to chill your blood, and you'll thank God Ryan Rayburn isn't your seatmate.
Diablitos, read by Santino Fontana.
Invisible and invincible, Ryan Rayburn III betrayed no trace of worry as he breezed through security and passport control of Nicoya's Guanacaste Airport. A cool American tourist, right up until they called him out of the boarding line, took him behind a screen, and ordered him to open his bag. Smiling guilelessly, he presented his boarding pass, declaration form, and passport to the hangdog customs agent. No big deal, you're just doing your job. None of the other passengers looked his way as they filed by. It had to be random. But he was a white man traveling alone. He probably wasn't going to blow up the plane, but odds were excellent he was holding contraband. Maybe even a mule for las drogas. This wasn't some banana republic where tourists got disappeared. Costa Rica was almost civilization. Hell, even better, since they didn't have an army and a safety patrol in lieu of state police. But La Mordida was still king. Ryan looked around for a supervisor or a camera, smiled nonchalantly, and fished 520s out of his money belt. The customs agent strapped on a pair of baby blue rubber gloves before commencing an autopsy of Ryan's duffel bag. Guanacaste was slightly fancier than most modern Latin American airports, but still had the ambiance of a cheap 70s sci-fi film set in a futuristic prison. Signs everywhere tried to shame flyers with images of hooded and handcuffed prisoners with tormented thought bubbles. Why did I try to smuggle? Stiff upper lip. Don't smile or try to chat him up. Don't do their job for them. The idiots they caught always broadcast their guilt in creepy, toxic waves that would kill a canary. He was doing nothing wrong. The security checkpoint didn't even know what they were looking at, and even if this guy did, it was hardly worth delaying the flight. He wasn't smuggling drugs or weapons. He was just another tourist, bringing back tourist stuff. The customs agent laid out clothing, camera equipment, and toiletries with the odd delicacy of a servant setting out a picnic. He excavated the whole bag, then reached in and peeled back the inner lining and unzipped the false bottom. "It's just a souvenir, sir," Ryan gulped like he was breathing through a wet towel. "Is there a problem? I bought it at a souvenir shop." The customs agent did not acknowledge him. He just stared into Ryan's bag with his hands planted on the scuffed stainless steel table. Then he coughed into his hand. Ryan looked around. fanning the cash in his hand, pushing it at the agent. A steady stream of passengers filed through the metal detector towards the departure gate. "My flight leaves in 10 minutes, friend." Still coughing, the customs agent dropped Ryan's travel documents and waved him away like a mosquito cloud. Strings of mucus sprayed out around his fist. Ryan hurriedly stuffed his bag and pocketed his cash, turned to go up a broken escalator and down a long, mostly unlit terminal to his gate before he noticed that his papers were sticky with saliva, dappled with blood. Jesus, some security. Tries to shake you down and gives you TB. It wasn't funny, but he had to laugh or he'd scream. They'd had him, caught him red-handed. The look in the agent's eyes when he opened the false bottom just before he got sick, it had gone a sickly pale olive, and his eyes just about rolled down his cheeks to fall in with the thing in his dirty laundry pouch. The sad bastard had known what he was looking at. He'd known, but he'd said nothing. Neither did he touch the money. If there was anything in the world that could make Ryan cross himself and utter a prayer, it would be the thing in his bag, but not because he believed in magic. Smuggling a kilo of uncut Colombian shouting powder might net 30 grand before it got stepped on. For the 2 pounds of hand-carved hardwood in his bag, Ryan might take twice that amount. But if he got caught down here, extradition and federal time in the States would be the best he could pray for. Ryan Rayburn III never set out to create the life he lived. He casually baited the lines and let it come to him. He blew his trust fund on a BA in art history, then trashed all remaining parental goodwill by bumming around South America instead of getting a job. After 3 years of misadventures and hard-won discoveries in the darkest corners of the earth, he finally learned the one lesson that his parents had tried to teach him back in Palo Alto. Being poor sucked. Back in California, Ryan resolved to convert his impractical degree into a career. He trawled the gallery scene and started picking up contacts for private art collectors and stumbled into the hothouse subculture of pre-Columbian artifact freaks. He did shopping trips from Mexico to Tierra del Fuego, cutting out layers of middlemen until he had a dozen dot-com millionaires in his client list. Half the antiquities in South America museums were fake, and archaeologists worked in secret to keep looters at bay. The UN and U.S. Customs had cracked several rings that operated around Palo Alto and Stanford, but Ryan didn't move in show-off circles. His clients didn't flash their grave robbery trophies at charity galas, and he didn't trade in the crap you'd see in National Geographic. The Shorakua lived in the high alpine valleys of the Cordillera de Talamanca, less than 200 miles from the capital, and yet a day's hike from the nearest navigable road. They were initially believed to be a virgin Stone Age tribe until 1950, when they were documented by a Smithsonian photographer. His photographs of the Shorakua harvest ritual told a tragic story of prior contact buried in the bizarre ceremony. A man, in a crude bull costume, rampaged around the huts of the village all night until just before dawn, when a procession of masked guardian spirits arrived to defeat the bull by spitting blood upon it until it weakened and died. The guardian spirits, called little devils or diablitos, were like the duendes, fairy spirits of protection against the threat of the Spanish colonists, who must have decimated their numbers with disease and driven the survivors into the most remote cloud forests of Talamanca. The Shorakua were primitive by any standard, having struggled too long and hard with basic survival to devise any elaborate cultural treasures. Their greeting to strangers was a formalized plea for food. But the harvest festival masks in those photographs were a revelation. Each mask was mouth-painted, airbrushed using paint spat through a reed, in livid, smoldering colors and elaborate motifs, more like runes than abstract motifs. Despite their hostile rejection of the outside world, the Shorakua masks inspired a collector's frenzy in the 70s. By 1982, the last Shorakua had died from influenza. but the neighboring tribes still feared their masks. With no analog anywhere in the region, they were stranger and more elaborate and fearsome than any Maya or Aztec deities, almost Polynesian in their fusion of human, insect, floral, and animal features, and imbued with a feral malevolence that made the most severe Gothic gargoyles look like Care Bears. From what he could find in print, he gathered they were a nasty variant on the Latin American fairies known as duendes. The word came from the Spanish dueños, or owners, because they were the true owners of any habitat they shared with humans. But the neighboring tribe's Spanish name for them, and for the Shorakua themselves, was more fitting for spirits never quite seen but keenly feared, diablitos, or little devils. Ryan had scored some incredible Moche burial charms on a sweep through Colombia and Peru, and successfully posted them to his drop contact in California. He flew to Panama City, drove a jeep into the Cordillera de Talamanca, just to hike Cerro La Muerte and chill out. He didn't expect to find any remnant of the Shorakua in the rudimentary museums and tourist traps in the nameless mountain villages, and he didn't. Fakes and pastiche trash, chiseled out of balsa wood and haphazardly airbrushed with acrylics by mestizo hillbillies who knew less about the Shorakua than Ryan's dumbest clients. Ryan Rayburn III never got anywhere by forcing success. That way lay madness and ulcers. Just ask Ryan II and Ryan I. He simply let good things gravitate to him, as they always had. An old blind woman outside a hut with a cooler full of blood-warm Fanta had made a strange gesture and coughed into her hand when he asked her granddaughter about the Shorakua. Coughed into her arthritic claw and opened it up, and a red butterfly took flight from her hand. The girl played mute, but while he was drinking his third Fanta, Ryan poked around the compound. All the men were off hunting or logging, and nobody saw him except a naked boy whose testicles had yet to descend. The huts were huddled in an octagon around a well, beside a waist-high soapstone idol, weathered and worn until its chiseled features were only vague dimples in the stone. Ryan nearly shouted and threw his soda in the air. It was a Shorakua village, or the revival of one, which was highly unlikely. Many tribes in the region buried their dead under their homes, then moved far away. The sight of a tribal extinction would be like a Stone Age Chernobyl. The old blind woman appeared then, and sold him the mask for $200. That was what he would tell anyone who asked. He told himself the story enough times by now that he almost believed it. What really happened was hardly the worst thing he'd ever done, and there was simply no point in reliving it. The mask was authentic. It looked like it weighed 100 pounds, but was carved of some unidentified purple-black jungle softwood that weighed less than water. The paints were indigenous pigments, the deep indigo derived from azul mata, the pale liquid gold extracted from onion skin, the fiery orange from achiote fruit, the lurid violet extracted from the glands of an endangered mollusk called munis, the unexpected splash of deeper, duller red on the inside of the mask looked less like an accident than a savage signature, and would probably only increase its value. He had a standing buyer on the line, two, actually, and fiercely jealous competitors. When his plane touched down at LAX, he could unload the mask for $50,000, maybe double that, if he held it long enough for discreetly seeded rumors to spark a bidding war. The exhausted purser at the gate held the door open for him without checking his papers. Stepping out onto the tarmac was like walking into a whirlwind of animal breath. The jungle closed in on all sides of the runway like walls of emerald fire. The Pura Vida Air 727 idled as the last straggling passengers hustled up the rolling stairway and into the hatch. The flight was just over half full, about 50 passengers, two-thirds American. Most of them had already turned out their lights and were trying to go to sleep. huddled under thin nylon blankets against recycled paper pillows. He groaned as he found his seat. 11A, by the window, just aft of the wing, beside a long-haired Caucasian beardo and a buxom Asian lady snuggling and tinkering with the faulty fan set into the ceiling. Perking up alarmingly as they got up to let him squeeze into the window seat, the man introduced himself as Dan, his wife, Lori.
"Need something to read?" he asked, holding out a paperback. "I wrote it myself."
"Quit bothering people, honey," his wife murmured.
Ryan shook his head and spread out on the empty seats across the aisle. The stewardess began the pre-flight emergency pantomime, gesturing to masks and escape hatches in time with the crackling recording in Spanish, when the last passenger stumbled down the narrow aisle and nearly sat on his bag. Ryan grabbed his bag out of the shadow of the large descending ass just in time. He started to say, "Watch where you're going, idiot," when he saw the white cane gripped in the fat old woman's hand. Ryan's whole body went rigid. He pushed back against the window, and if he'd been seated next to an escape hatch, he might have grabbed the latch and popped it and leapt out under the wing. He threw up a defensive arm and tried to squeeze out of the seat. The blind woman stumbled against the steward who had helped her to the seat, then rebounded off the arm of 11C and threw out an arm to catch herself before she fell into his arms. At second glance, his seatmate was just a girl, maybe 13, with a long horsey face and terrible acne scars. Her eyes bulged out of her head like unscrewed light bulbs. Her pupils rolled up to stare through the ceiling, half obscured by heavy, sleepy lids. Her white cane snapped out to jab his ankles. He took a second to catch his breath, longer to collect his thoughts. With so many empty seats, why on earth would they put her next to him? A young American man traveling alone, sitting next to a blind foreign girl, was asking for trouble. Aren't there a lot of other seats on the plane? The steward returned to the tail of the aisle to help lip-sync the tail end of the safety instructions. Perhaps deaf as well as blind, or perhaps she didn't speak Spanish, the girl lowered herself into 11D and sat with her knees tightly together and a hand-woven native bag trapped in her arms. The plane bumbled backwards and then taxied onto the runway with a woozy, rolling speed that made Ryan wonder who was flying the plane. Maybe the blind girl could go to the cockpit and help. The turbines were winding up when Ryan noticed the girl hadn't buckled her seatbelt. "Señorita, your belt should be fastened." She rocked slightly but didn't respond. A tiny crucifix and a string of glow-in-the-dark plastic rosary beads clutched in her hands, frequently rising up to kiss her thick, chapped lips. The stewardess was buckled in at the front. Apparently, it was his responsibility. For duty and humanity, he thought, as he reached over to fasten the belt. "Let me help you." The girl's hands trapped his in a sweaty, trembling vice. She cried out as if he'd woken her from a sound sleep to find herself groped, empty eyes staring as if she could see his face floating in her perpetual darkness. Wrenching his hands free, he tried to calm her down without touching her again, but it was no use. She didn't seem to hear or understand him, and she was already in a panic over the flight and being pawed by some strange man in the middle of it. Feeling vaguely ashamed, he looked around for help, but no one seemed to notice. The escalating howl of the engines drowned out her screaming, and then the drunken lurch of acceleration flattened them into their seats. When the landing gear folded up and the plane leveled off, she went back to her silent prayer. Ryan turned his face to the wall and wadded his sweatshirt into a pillow. Outside, the blinking red light on the wing danced and bled as streaks of rain raced across the glass. The little coastal city was engulfed in tufts of fog like giant kites snarled in the trees. Only a few lost lights that might have been ships at sea testified that the city he'd just escaped was still down there. Ryan was a seasoned traveler. He could sleep anywhere, under any circumstances. He clenched his legs tight around the duffel bag on the floor and tried to empty his mind. It took a while, though, because every time he felt himself sliding into slumber, The blind girl coughed loudly into her fist. His mind kept circling back around to the mask. The customs agent had started coughing up blood at the sight of it, but let him go. Was that just some kind of crazy coincidence? The Shorakua were wiped out by disease, so it figured their folklore would invent some kind of magical spirits for protection or revenge. But fat fucking lot of good it did them. They were long gone. Their weird, sad little religion, just an anthrotext footnote that fascinated millionaires who needed bloodthirsty pagan gods for poker partners. Were the masks some kind of vector for spreading a virus? That would explain something if he had gotten sick, but aside from the usual tropical rashes and maladies, he felt fine. He didn't believe in curses, unless you counted poverty. They had leveled off at 30,000 feet when Ryan decided he wasn't going to sleep, and decided to work on getting drunk. He rubbed his eyes with the heels of his hands for a while. Maybe he should try to apologize to the blind girl, or better yet, move to another seat. He turned to size her up, and found himself eye to eye with the Shorakua mask. She was wearing it. The whites of her empty eyes glinted through the slits cut into the beetling, jaguar-mottled brow. Every plane of the angular face was painted a different animal texture, as if to tie all the life of the jungle into its vengeful visage. But now, on the blind girl's face, it came to life. The stylized branching horns jutting from the jawline and temples glowed cobalt blue, like gas jet flames. The interlaced fangs in the snarling mouth slid apart like the tumblers of a lock, and a torrent of black rancid blood jetted out over the curled lips to splash down the front of his shirt. He jumped up and smashed his head into the luggage compartment, fell back into his seat. The blood all over him was cold and sticky, and alive with twitching, scuttling things that disappeared under his clothing before he could tear them off. His screams went unheard by the other passengers. The blind girl's bony arms barred his escape. She pressed closer, still coughing up gouts of infested blood, and he was drenched and drowning in it when he threw out his hands to pry the mask off her face. The mask came off with a sound like rusty nails worming out of rotten wood. It took her face off with it, and she crushed him into the wall, her cold, slimy cheekbone hard against his chest. He might have screamed when he woke up. His face was stuck to the cold window. Every other part of his body was crawling with sweat. He was groggy, as if he'd popped a couple Ambien on top of a few shots of tequila. Slowly, deliberately, he turned and looked at the blind girl. She sat bolt upright in her seat, her head thrown back against the unyielding headrest, her steady breath like plumbing gurgling past a ferocious blockage. Her tray table was unfolded, and a half-empty styrofoam cup rested on it beside a foil bag with some kind of pickled fruit spilling out of it, and her plastic rosary beads glowing like plutonium in the blue murk. Beverage service had come and gone while he slept. Her dress was homespun cotton, richly embroidered with garish butterflies and birds. As he studied her, fighting the urge to pinch himself, she was racked with a string of wet, red, choking coughs. "Fuck this noise," he thought, and grabbed his bag. Gingerly clearing the junk from her tray table, he folded it against the back of 10C and undid his seatbelt. The cabin was hotter than the fucking Yucatan. His inner ears throbbed, as they always did when he flew, but they felt like he was deep underwater and not skipping over the upper atmosphere. The only light came from the spotty fiber-optic strips along the aisle, and a couple spotlights over passengers nodding over laptops or reading Kindles with iPod plugs in their ears. Moving one limb at a time, with total concentration, he levered himself out of his seat and threw a leg over the girl's knees to plant his foot in the aisle. It was a good plan, and he was careful as hell. But his foot slipped on something, and he skidded into the splits with a stifled yelp. The girl's knees jabbed his ass. He braced himself for the shrieking and batting fists, but they never came. The girl coughed so hard he felt the wet force of her expelled breath through his shirt. Fighting panic, he lurched over her into the aisle, dragging his duffel bag and swinging it over the slumbering head of the passenger in 10C, a fat mother with a mustache and a double armload of squirming kids in her lap. He must have been out for a couple hours. The plane bounced off roiling pockets of turbulence somewhere over the lightless Mexican interior. The aisle was clear, except for a couple of cups rolling in loopy circles with the rise and fall of the plane. The stewardess was nowhere in sight. Ryan hurried down the aisle, trying not to bump into passengers' dangling arms and legs. The last row of seats before the restroom was empty, and he made for them like a seasick drunk. The plane dipped alarmingly just as he reached the seats and fell into them. His heart raced, muscles jittered with spurts of misspent adrenaline. His bag felt weightless as he dropped it into the window seat. Holy shit, but he'd got himself worked up. He needed a drink. Maybe the stewardess would let him buy a bottle of hard stuff. Hell, maybe she'd share it with him. He deserved something good after everything he'd been through. He cradled the duffel bag against his hip. It was weightless because it was empty. Shock galvanized him. Ripping the zipper open, he plunged his hand into the bag and found himself looking at his grabbing hand again, when it popped out the ragged hole in the bottom of the bag. Only a couple pairs of rolled-up tube socks and some boxer shorts were still in the bag, and they were wet, clinging to the walls of the bag in a slimy black paste. The hole was not just a rip in the double-walled nylon, it was a gaping circular fucking hole, like the material had been dissolved or chewed up. Fuck, he seethed through gritted teeth, looking up the aisle at the scattered yard sale of his possessions trailing all the way back to his old seat. He staggered down the aisle, scooping up slimy piles of clothing. Finally, his hand caught something with heft to it that he snatched up with a grateful whimper, but it turned out to be his shaving kit. He felt eyes tracking him and the unmistakable sense of someone laughing at his predicament, but every face was turned away, tucked into its neighbor's shoulder or tilted back, mouth agape. The whine of the engine seemed to subside, the plane to rock laterally, and the cups in the aisle tumbled towards the nose. Were they descending already? Finally, he reached his old seat. Dan and Lori were fast asleep. The carpet was spongy with pooled fluid all around the blind girl in 11D. She must have thrown up, he thought with distaste. Or wet herself. His mask was not anywhere in the aisle, so it must have fallen out under his seat when he made his escape. From there, it could have rolled away with the turbulence, could be anywhere in the goddamned plane. There was nothing else to do but go looking. He started to kneel beside the blind girl. The plane tilted nose down and sent him sprawling to the floor. He threw his hands out to save his head and caught an armrest in the eye. He fell to the deck and laughed at his clumsiness when something stabbed him. A bolt of pure agony was driven by his falling weight into his right leg, just under his right kneecap, until it popped through the tender flesh between the thongs of tendon and muscle at the back of his knee. It hurt worse than anything he'd ever experienced, until he tried to straighten his leg, and whatever had intruded into the delicate mechanism of his knee snapped inside him. And then pain became his whole wide world. Howling, he crumpled on the deck, hugging his impaled knee to his chest. He screamed over and over, but it didn't dawn on him right away how strange it was that for all his screaming, nobody on the plane had reacted at all. Reaching out for the couple in 11B and C, he yanked the blanket off them so Dan's novel fell into the aisle. They knocked heads, and the husband slumped onto his tray table. A rivulet of deep red flowed out from his left nostril, out of which protruded the hilt of a coffee stirrer. His wife belched, and something crawled out of her open mouth, a red shadow slathered in bright arterial blood. A moan escaped his slack, flapping lips. He He rocked back on his leg and was jolted by a fresh stroke of agony. His right leg had a knife in it. Pulling back the leg of his jeans, he saw a white plastic hilt protruding from the wound in the depression just under his kneecap. A wave of nausea threatened to carry him away when he looked at it, but pure disbelief kept him staring. He'd been stabbed with a plastic knife. The point of it poked out the other side, whittled or chewed until it was sharp as a scalpel. He turned and pawed at the blind girl, hoping to make her scream like a fire alarm, but she only flopped over her armrest to knock her long, hollow skull against Ryan's forehead. Her mouth hung open, lips flecked with glossy red stains that matched the mire he was sitting in. Her skin was cold as marble, her limbs loose and inert as a doll's, but she shook against him, racked by a post-mortem coughing fit. They came out of her mouth. With the racking cough, they scrambled out over her lips and down into the sunken meadow of her lap to leer at him over the armrest. They looked like beetles or stick insects with their fluted thoraxes and tapered exoskeletal limbs. Their bodies borrowed promiscuously from the insect, reptile, and amphibian clades, but their hideous faces were, or were hidden behind, miniature Shorakua harvest masks. The tallest of them was not quite 8 inches high, but looking down on him from their perch, they owned him. Ryan dragged himself backwards, down the aisle towards the cockpit. Everywhere he looked, he saw them creeping over corpses, peering down at him from behind headrests. He passed the mother with her children, bloated and black with asphyxiation, and a businessman slouched over his laptop, ballpoint pens shoved into the ruins of his eyes. And the stewardess, the broken neck of an imperial beer bottle sticking out of a new mouth in her neck. He dragged himself backwards, until the solid armored bulk of the cockpit door stopped him. Everyone in the plane was dead, but cockpits were like bank vaults these days. He thrashed against the door, screaming for them to open it before he was killed. Something killed everyone on the plane, but it wasn't him. He was innocent, and he didn't deserve to die. "Ladies and gentlemen, we thank you for flying Pura Vida Air, and ask that you wait until the plane has come to a complete stop before activating personal electronics or attempting to retrieve luggage." It was a calm, almost sleepy voice, soothing and pre-recorded. They weren't scheduled to be over Los Angeles for another hour. The door stayed sealed. The crew on the other side might be dead too, or they might be totally oblivious to what was going on. He turned to look for a phone. The darkness leapt out of the seats to fill the aisle and came streaming towards him like army ants. He pounded on the door, shrieking beyond words, but they did not come to kill him. They wanted him to have the mask. They brought it to him and laid it on the deck. They wanted him to wear it. The plane shuddered as its landing gear was lowered into the screaming wind. The cabin was still a lightless cavern, but the ugly amber sodium glow of Tijuana poured in the windows like the overflow of a public urinal. Huddled against the door, it slowly dawned on him that he didn't have to die. Numbly, he picked up the mask, seeing it too late with new eyes. It was not a trinket or a treasure, or even a mask. It was a door. The blood he'd spilled had opened it. To let them leave this place, the door only had to open again. It was simple, when there was no other choice but to accept. Ryan put the mask to his face. The hard, rough inner surface caressed him with splinters that grew and intertwined under his skin. They climbed each other to reach his lips. The narrow, fanged mouth only allowed one at a time, and they were beyond counting. They scuttled up his shivering body and into the gate of teeth, but he could feel them piling up inside his belly. Restless, hungry for trouble, and he could feel a whole new world, cold, black, and infinite inside. Before the last one had disappeared into his mouth, the 727 touched down with a rough jerk and skidded on the tarmac as if the runway were a plane of loose boulders. When the plane finally pirouetted to a stop and the cabin lights turned on, not a single passenger stirred to turn on cell phones or try to pull their luggage out of the overheads. Ryan hauled himself to his feet and knocked once more on the cockpit door. But whatever was on the other side was quite content to stay behind. He pulled the latch on the cabin door and turned the wheel. Two baggage handlers pressed quizzical faces to the porthole and tapped on the glass. Ryan smiled at them, forgetting he was wearing a mask, and threw open the door. He tried to explain, but they didn't see him at all. They fell to their knees, choking on red phlegm. He pushed past them and skipped down the stairs to kneel and kiss the tarmac with a forked black tongue. It was so good, after all his wandering, to be at home.
Air Raid by John Varley. John Varley was born in Texas and went to Michigan State University on a national merit scholarship, supposedly because of the schools he could afford. MSU was the farthest from Texas. There are science fiction writers who have brilliant ideas, and science fiction writers who are fine prose stylists. Varley is one of the fortunate few who are both. Air Raid was published in 1977 under the pen name Herb Beam, an amalgam of his middle name and his mother's maiden name, because he had another story appearing in the same issue of Asimov's. Was nominated for both a Hugo and a Nebula Award, was expanded into the novel Millennium in 1983, and became a movie in 1989. Once you start this one, you won't be able to put it down. So welcome aboard Sunbelt Airlines Flight 128, departing Miami and bound for New York. The passengers, however, may be heading for a far different destination.
Air Raid. Read by Elizabeth Marvel. I was jerked awake by the silent alarm vibrating my skull. It won't shut down until you sit up, so I did. All around me in the darkened bunk room, the snatch team members were sleeping singly and in pairs. I yawned, scratched my ribs, and patted Gene's hairy flank. He turned over. So much for a romantic send-off. Rubbing sleep from my eyes, I reached to the floor for my leg, strapped it on, and plugged it in. Then I was running down the rows of bunks toward ops. The situation board glowed in the gloom. Sunbelt Airlines Flight 128, Miami to New York, September 15th, 1979. We'd been looking for that one for 3 years. I should have been happy, but who can afford it when you wake up? Liza Boston muttered past me on the way to prep. I muttered back and followed. The lights came on around the mirrors, and I groped my way to one of them. Behind us, three more people staggered in. I sat down, plugged in, and at last, I could lean back and close my eyes. They didn't stay closed for long. Rush! I sat up straight as the sludge I use for blood was replaced with supercharged go juice. I looked around me and got a series of idiot grins. There was Liza, and Pinky, and Dave. Against the far wall, Christabel was already turning slowly in front of the airbrush, getting a Caucasian paint job. It looked like a good team. I opened the drawer and started preliminary work on my face. It's a bigger job every time. Transfusion or no, I looked like death. The right ear was completely gone now. I could no longer close my lips. The gums were permanently bared, A week earlier, a finger had fallen off in my sleep. And what's it to you, bugger? While I worked, one of the screens around the mirror glowed. A smiling young woman, blonde, high brow, round face. Close enough. The crawl line read Mary Katrina Sondergaard, born Trenton, New Jersey, age in 1979, 25. Baby, this is your lucky day. The computer melted the skin away from her face to show me the bone structure, rotated it, gave me cross-sections. I studied the similarities with my own skull, noted the differences. Not bad, and better than some I'd been given. I assembled a set of dentures that included the slight gap in the upper incisors. Putty filled out my cheeks, contact lenses fell from the dispenser, and I popped them in. Nose plugs widened my nostrils. No need for ears. They'd be covered by the wig. I pulled a blank plastiflesh mask over my face and had to pause while it melted in. It took only a minute to mold it to perfection. I smiled at myself. How nice to have lips. The delivery slot clunked and dropped a blonde wig and a pink outfit into my lap. The wig was hot from the styler. I put it on, then the pantyhose.
Mandy, did you get the profile on Sondergaard?
I didn't look up. I recognized the voice. Roger.
We've located her near the airport. We can slip you in before takeoff, so you'll be the joker.
I groaned and looked up at the face on the screen. Elfrida Baltimore Louisville, director of operational teams. Lifeless face and tiny slits for eyes. What can you do when all the muscles are dead?
Okay.
You take what you get. She switched off, and I spent the next 2 minutes trying to get dressed while keeping my eyes on the screens. I memorized names and faces of crew members, plus the few facts known about them. Then I hurried out and caught up with the others. Elapsed time from the first alarm, 12 minutes and 7 seconds. We better get moving.
Goddamn sunbelt!
Christabel groused, hitching at her bra.
At least they got rid of the high heels,
Dave pointed out. A year earlier, we would have been teetering down the aisles on 3-inch platforms. We all wore short pink shifts with blue and white stripes diagonally across the front and carried matching shoulder bags. I fussed trying to get the ridiculous pillbox cap pinned on. We jogged into the dark operations control room and lined up at the gate. Things were out of our hands now. Until the gate was ready, we could only wait. I was first, a few feet away from the portal. I turned away from it. It gives me vertigo. I focused instead on the gnomes sitting at their consoles, bathed in yellow lights from their screens. None of them looked back at me. They don't like us much. I don't like them either. Withered, emaciated, all of them. Our fat legs and butts and breasts are a reproach to them. A reminder that snatchers eat 5 times their ration to stay presentable for the masquerade. Meantime, we continue to rot. One day, I'll be sitting at a console. One day, I'll be built into a console, with all my guts on the outside and nothing left of my body but stink. The hell with them. I buried my gun under a clutter of tissues and lipsticks in my purse. Elfrida was looking at me. Where is she? I asked.
Motel room. She was alone from 10 p.m. to noon on flight day.
Departure time was 1:15. She cut it close and would be in a hurry. Good. Can you catch her in the bathroom? Best of all, in the tub?
We're working on it.
She sketched a smile with a fingertip drawn over lifeless lips. She knew how I liked to operate, but she was telling me I'd take what I got. It never hurts to ask. People are at their most defenseless, stretched out and up to their necks in water.
Go!
Elfrida shouted. I stepped through, and things started to go wrong. I was faced the wrong way, stepping out of the bathroom door and facing the bedroom. I turned and spotted Mary Katrina Sondergaard through the haze of the gate. There was no way I could reach her without stepping back through. I couldn't even shoot without hitting someone on the other side. Sondergaard was at the mirror, the worst possible place. Few people recognized themselves quickly, but she'd been looking right at herself. She saw me, and her eyes widened. I stepped to the side, out of her sight. What the hell is... Hey! Who the hell? I noted the voice, which can be the trickiest thing to get right. I figured she'd be more curious than afraid. My guess was right. She came out of the bathroom, passing through the gate as if it wasn't there, which it wasn't, since it only has one side. She had a towel wrapped around her. Jesus Christ! What are you doing in my... Words fail you at a time like that. She knew she ought to say something, but what? Excuse me, haven't I seen you in the mirror? I put on my best Stew smile and held out my hand. Pardon the intrusion, I can explain everything. You see, I hit her on the side of the head and she staggered and went down hard. Her towel fell to the floor. Working my way through college. She started to get up, so I caught her under the chin with my artificial knee. She stayed down. Standard fucking oil, I hissed, rubbing my injured knuckles. But there was no time. I knelt beside her, checked her pulse. She'd be okay, but I think I loosened some front teeth. I paused a moment. Lord, to look like that with no makeup, no prosthetics. She nearly broke my heart. I grabbed her under the knees and wrestled her to the gate. She was a sack of limp noodles. Somebody reached through, grabbed her feet, and pulled. So long, love. How would you like to go on a long voyage? I sat on a rented bed to get my breath. There were car keys and cigarettes in her purse. Genuine tobacco, worth its weight in blood. I lit six of them, figuring I had 5 minutes of my very own. The room filled with sweet smoke. They don't make them like that anymore. The Hertz sedan was in the motel parking lot. I got in and headed for the airport. I breathed deeply of the air, rich in hydrocarbons. I could see for hundreds of yards into the distance. The perspective nearly made me dizzy, but I live for those moments. There's no way to explain what it's like in the pre-mech world. The sun was a fierce yellow ball through the haze. The other Stews were boarding. Some of them knew Sondergaard, so I didn't say much, pleading a hangover. That went over well, with a lot of knowing laughs and sly remarks. Evidently, it wasn't out of character. We boarded the 707 and got ready for the goats to arrive. It looked good. The four commandos on the other side were identical twins for the women I was working with. There was nothing to do but be a stewardess until departure time. I hoped there would be no more glitches. Inverting a gate for a joker run into a motel room was one thing, but in a 707 at 20,000 feet? The plane was nearly full when the woman that Pinky would impersonate sealed the forward door. We taxied to the end of the runway. Then we were airborne. I started taking orders for drinks in first. The goats were the usual lot. For 1979. Fat and sassy, all of them. And as unaware of living in a paradise as a fish is of the sea. What would you think, ladies and gents, of a trip to the future? No? I can't say I'm surprised. What if I told you this plane is going to... My arm beeped as we reached cruising altitude. I consulted the indicator under my Lady Bulova and glanced at one of the restroom doors. I felt a vibration pass through the plane. Damn it! Not so soon! The gate was in there. I came out quickly and motioned for Diana Gleason, Dave's pigeon, to come to the front. Take a look at this, I said with a disgusted look. She started to enter the restroom. Stopped when she saw the green glow. I planted a boot on her fanny and shoved. Perfect. Dave would have a chance to hear her voice before popping in, though she'd be doing a little bit screaming when she got a look around. Dave came through the gate, adjusting his silly little hat. Diana must have struggled.
"Be disgusted,"
I whispered.
"What a mess," he said as he came out of the restroom. It was a fair imitation of Diana's tone, though he'd missed the accent. It wouldn't matter much longer.
"What is it?"
It was one of the stews from Tourist. We stepped aside so she could get a look, and Dave shoved her through. Pinky popped out very quickly.
"We're minus on minutes," Pinky said. "We lost 5 on the other side."
5?
Dave Diana squeaked.
I felt the same way. We had 103 passengers to process.
"Yeah. They lost control after you pushed my pigeon through. It took that long to realign."
"You get used to that. Time runs at different rates on each side of the gate, though it's always sequential, past to future." Once we'd started the snatch with me entering Sondergaard's room, there was no way to go back any earlier on either side. Here, in 1979, we had a rigid 94 minutes to get everything done. On the other side, the gate could never be maintained longer than 3 hours.
"When you left, how long was it since the alarm went in?"
28 minutes.
It didn't sound good. It would take at least 2 hours just customizing the wimps.
Assuming there was no more slippage on 79 time, we might just make it.
But there's always slippage.
I shuddered, thinking about writing it in. "No time for any more games then," I said.
"Pink, you go back to Tourist and call both of the other girls up here. Tell them to come one at a time, and tell them we've got a problem. You know the bit."
"Biting back the tears, got you." She hurried aft. In no time, the first one showed up. Her friendly Sunbelt Airlines smile was stamped on her face, but her stomach would be churning.
"Oh, God, this is it."
I took her by the elbow and pulled her behind the curtains in front. She was breathing hard.
"Welcome to the Twilight Zone," I said, and put the gun to her head.
She slumped, and I caught her. Pinky and Dave helped me shove her through the gate.
"Fuck! The rotting thing's flickering."
Pinky was right, a very ominous sign. But the green glow stabilized as we watched, with who knows how much slippage on the other side. Christabel ducked through.
"We're plus 33, she said.
There was no sense talking about what we were all thinking. Things were going badly.
"Back to Tourist," I said. "Be brave, smile at everyone, but make it just a little bit too good. Got it?"
"Check,"
Christabel said. We processed the other quickly, with no incident. Then there was no time to talk about anything. In 89 minutes, Flight 128 was going to be spread all over a mountain, whether we were finished or not. Dave went into the cockpit to keep the flight crew out of our hair. Me and Pinky were supposed to take care of first class, then back up Christabel and Liza in Tourist. We used the standard coffee, tea, or milk gambit, relying on our speed and their inertia. I leaned over the first two seats on the left.
"Are you enjoying your flight?"
Pop, pop. 2 squeezes on the trigger, close to the heads and out of sight of the rest of the goats.
"Hi, folks. I'm Mandy."
"Fly me." Pop, pop.
Halfway to the galley, a few people were watching us curiously. But people don't make a fuss until they have a lot more to go on. One goat in the back row stood up, and I let him have it. By now, there were only 8 left awake. I abandoned the smile and squeezed off 4 quick shots. Pinky took care of the rest. We hurried through the curtains just in time. There was an uproar building in the back of Tourist, with about 60% of the goats already processed. Christabel glanced at me, and I nodded.
"Okay, folks," she bawled. "I want you to be quiet. Calm down and listen up. You, fathead, pipe down before I cram my foot up your ass sideways."
The shock of hearing her talk like that was enough to buy us a little time anyway. We had formed a skirmish line across the width of the plane,
guns out, steadied on seat backs, aimed at the milling, befuddled group of 30 goats. The guns are enough to awe all but the most foolhardy. In essence, a standard-issue stunner is just a plastic rod with two grids about 6 inches apart. There's not enough metal in it to set off a hijack alarm. And to people from the Stone Age to about 2190, it doesn't look any more like a weapon than a ballpoint pen. So equipment section jazzes them up in a plastic shell to real Buck Rogers blasters with a dozen knobs and lights that flash and a barrel like the snout of a hog. Hardly anyone ever walks into one. We are in great danger and time is short. You must all do exactly as I tell you, and you will be safe. You can't give them time to think. You have to rely on your status as the voice of authority. The situation is just not going to make sense to them, no matter how you explain it.
Just a minute. I think you owe us.
An airborne lawyer. I made a snap decision, thumbed the firework switch on my gun, and shot him. The gun made a sound like a flying saucer with hemorrhoids, spit sparks and little jets of flame, and extended a green laser finger to his forehead. He dropped. All pure kark, of course, but it sure is impressive. And it's damn risky, too. I had to choose between a panic if the fathead got them to thinking, and a possible panic from the flash of the gun. But when a 20th gets to talking about his rights and what he's owed, things can get out of hand. It's infectious. It worked. There was a lot of shouting, people ducking behind seats, but no rush. We could have handled it, but we needed some of them conscious if we were ever going to finish the snatch.
Get up! Get up, you slugs! Christabel yelled. He's stunned, nothing worse. But I'll kill the next one who gets out of line. Now get to your feet and do what I tell you. Children first! Hurry as fast as you can to the front of the plane. Do what the stewardess tells you. Come on, kids, move!
I ran back into first class just ahead of the kids, turned at the open restroom door, and got on my knees. They were petrified. There were 5 of them. Crying, some of them, which always chokes me up. Looking left and right at dead people in the first-class seats, stumbling, near panic. Come on, kids, I called to them, giving my special smile. Your parents will be along in just a minute. Everything's going to be all right. I promise you. Come on. I got 3 of them through. The 4th balked. She was determined not to go through that door. She spread her legs and arms, and I could not push her through. I will not hit a child, never. She raked her nails over my face. My wig came off, and she gaped at my bare head. I shoved her through. Number 5 was sitting in the aisle, bawling. He was maybe 7. I ran back and picked him up, hugged him and kissed him, and tossed him through. God, I needed a rest, but I was needed in tourist. You, and you. Okay, you too. Help him, will you? Pinky had a practiced eye for the ones that wouldn't be any use to anyone, even themselves. We herded them toward the front of the plane, then deployed ourselves along the left side where we could cover the workers. It didn't take long to prod them into action. We had them dragging the limp bodies forward as fast as they could go. Me and Christabel were in tourist with the others up front. Adrenaline was being